This is Dan from Karate Cafe. You are listening to the Practical Defense Podcast with Alex Haddix, where he punches your brain face with his mind fists.
Welcome to the Practical Defense Podcast, where you'll learn practical approaches to staying safe in our increasingly dangerous urban environments. I'm your host, Alex Haddix, and this is episode 214, Kevlar Questions and Answers with Doc Wesson. So Doc Wesson returns to the show for a third time to answer listener questions about Kevlar. Now, we sifted through all the questions that came in on the show's Facebook page, the GRN message boards, and personal emails to Doc and to me. We then took a few examples of the most common questions that we could actually answer and recorded our discussion. But before we get to the interview, we have some interesting things going on here behind the scenes. Now, first, I am really happy to report that my book sales continue to be stronger than I ever thought possible. So thank you to everyone who is buying, reading, and sharing my book. I expected sales to drop off at this point, but they continue to be solid at nearly five times the numbers that I expected. I also have some really great international news. Although my book has technically sold internationally, since the ebooks have sold in Canada, the UK, France, Australia, and Germany, these have been the non-translated English versions sold into those regions. Well, to my surprise and extreme joy, a publishing company in Greece approached me to release the book over there. This is going to be a full translation and reprinting of the book into Greek. So I've already signed the contract with them, and the book should be available in about 2 to 3 months. They're going to send me a few copies when it becomes available. So this means the book has gone truly international, which just kind of blows my mind. I've started work on my next book, but it is a highly specialized firearms manual that will have almost zero broad appeal. I'm writing as much for myself as perhaps the 10 other people who might be interested in reading it. Now, I'm going to keep the rest to myself as I'm only about a quarter of the way done with the first draft. Now seriously, for the 10 people that want this information, it will be pure gold. But to the other 99.9% of the population, it will have absolutely no appeal. Moving on, I know that Doc is a guest on this show this week, but last week I was a guest on his show. The program is called The Gun Nation, and he and his co-host, Average Joe, had me on to discuss defensive tactics that do not involve firearms. It was a long show, you know, going almost 2 hours. I think it was like the final production was like a 1 hour, 45 minutes. And you can find Doc's show at gunnation.us or in iTunes. Now, this coming week, I'm also going to be a guest on a non-self-defense show. I've been invited to appear on the Speaking of Wealth show with Jason Hartman. We're actually not going to talk about self-defense, but rather podcasting. His show is about entrepreneurs and marketing, and he wants to talk to me about how podcasts can be used to promote brands and products. It'll be an interesting discussion about what goes on behind the microphone to get the shows out every week. Okay, I think we've covered just about everything. So sit tight, and we'll be right back with Doc Wesson and more on Kevlar vests.
The legal aftermath of using a gun in self-defense can be traumatic and expensive. Get help and peace of mind through the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network. Network members receive much-needed financial and legal support right after a self-defense incident. They also receive education in the form of DVDs from some of the top names in the business, along with having access to a nationwide pool of attorneys. Learn about membership at www.armedcitizensnetwork.org.
Welcome back. And once again, we have Doc Wesson with us to once again talk about Kevlar vests. The episodes that we ran with him were so popular, and they generated so many questions about Kevlar that we had to bring Doc back a third time. So welcome back, Doc.
Oh, thank you, Alex. Third time's a charm.
Absolutely. So yeah, it was just really popular episode, and amount of interest that it generated. I mean, I knew it was going to be an interesting topic, but the amount of comments that we received in email, you got personal messages. We got messages and lots of posts to the Gun Rights Radio Network message boards, and we got a lot of posts to the Facebook page. So
exactly.
So there were a lot of things that came up, things that we stressed during it that I think may have been overstressed.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'd like to do is, you know, take the time and run some clarifications and answer some of these questions.
Well, we'll do the best we can.
So let's start with the first one, which I think was one of the biggest ones, is the episode that we ran. People got the impression that Kevlar was fragile because of what we were talking about with the wicking and the water and the manufacturing process. But based on our discussions afterwards, Kevlar's not that fragile. Could you go into a little more detail about that?
Yeah, it's not. You've got to remember when I'm talking about it, I'm really talking about it from a manufacturing type standpoint and from the, you know, I guess the scientific standpoint of it. You know, obviously anything that you put out in the sun eventually will degrade. It's, you know, with moisture, with sunlight. Kevlar will do that, but it's very simple. The way you take care of it is you treat it with a chemical to keep the moisture off of it. And then you wrap it basically in what would be equivalent to like an airtight bag, which would be some type of nylon or something to that nature that actually does fairly good in, you know, sunlight, maybe a polyester bag or something like that. So if you're actually looking into a vest, you'll see that the panels are actually inside encapsulated in a material, which is a fabric that's been sewn into basically a bag to fit those panels in. Now, I'll give you an example. I actually produced a bag out of Kevlar and basically encapsulated it with monolithic film. And what I mean by that is it's not film that has any type of perforations or any type of way or entry for water or gas to go in and out. It's basically a monolith, this one structure. And we, you know, produce that, and it actually is being used underwater in, you know, in the ocean. So it's not, you know, I think I pushed that part so much just based on the fact that, yes, you want to try to take care of it, but you want to try to take care of everything. And let's face it, you know, this stuff is going to be there to help you when you're getting shot at. But, Kevlar is an amazing, amazing fiber. And it's really rugged when you look at it in the right way. You just have to kind of protect it.
Okay. And the fact that it has, you know, under combat conditions, been used for, you know, decades now.
Yes.
And has a proven record as being reliable and, you know, working really, really well and protecting and saving lives.
Absolutely.
Under combat conditions for a long time. So it is more durable than I think our initial discussion made it out to be.
Quite correct. Basically, if you were to actually take just a piece of Kevlar that's not treated, the fabric, lay it out in the sun, eventually you'll see that it does start to change. But then so does, you know, anything else, you know, with when it weathers, so to speak. But no, this is protected. And it's the measures that are taken in the processing and putting this thing together, like the vests, helmets, et cetera, you know, take into account for the moisture to where literally it does – that moisture really doesn't have that much of a chance with it. But, you know, but again, heat, anything like that is an energy, and it does tend to work on things. But it's not like it's going to be, you know, tomorrow or next week. They put these, I guess, quote unquote type shelf lives on these vests. They're not a year, you know, so – it's just, you know, you want to take the same precautions you would with basically anything. But it's a very robust system. It is a very robust system.
Excellent. Now, the next biggest question that we had was about who should I buy my vest from? What is a good vest to buy? And I know you cannot answer that.
Right.
So, but I just wanted to address the fact that you work in the research and development and manufacturing process and cannot go on in any particular vendor, despite the fact that half the questions are, who should I buy from?
Yeah, we got a lot of that. I can recommend that you go out and look, you know, at people that actually retail and sell these things. You know, what we do is when we produce them, we actually make the fabric, and we will treat the fabric depending on what type of treatment and what end use it's going to be going into. And then, of course, we sell that material to a manufacturer, say like Point Blank. You know, what they'll end up, or MSA, for instance, and those are two really big guys. what they'll do in turn is, I guess, potentially sell that themselves or sell it to a retailer type. I know, like, for instance, Galls, I think, sells, you know. Police One is another place. I don't have any type of, you know, dealings with those folks at all. What I was trying to get across was just, you know, make sure that you see a name as far as manufacturing on the tag goes that you're familiar with. Like, you know, Point Blank, any of those. You can go on Google and actually look up, like, you know, body armor manufacturers. And they'll give you a list of it. And I just did it, you know. And there's a number of websites that come up. And I'm looking at just a few of them. And it, you know, it lists MSA, Armor Express, Point Blank, you know, all U.S. Armor, a lot of the big guys. And those are the, you know, those are the guys you kind of want to see. It's more important that's the point, is the manufacturer of how they put it together, because it's the quality control that you want to deal with. And as far as the retailer goes, yeah, I don't know really anything about cost-wise or how, you know, the best area to go to look for the type of vests or whatever. There's so many different, you know, there's, of course, the smock, and then there's the vests for different levels and whatnot that are done by the manufacturers. I don't know that they're all sold at the same retailers. But once again, if you go and type in Google, you know, retailers, it is a whole host of them that pop up. And typically if you go to that site, you'll go back and see that they're actually touting these manufacturers of the vests. So yeah, I wish I knew more about the retailers, but I really don't. I really don't. I'm not on that end of it.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, a lot of times, like Galls doesn't actually make their vests.
Exactly.
They relabel another manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of possibility that, you know, there may be 16 manufacturers or 16 retailers or brands, but there right. could only be like a handful of actual manufacturers producing the actual product, and they're just
exactly.
relabeled.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. It's but like, once again, we were talking about it earlier. They changed all of the requirements. The NIJ, National Institute of Justice, changed the parameters and the specifications to get the threat levels. And in doing that, they increased the testing, and the testing became so expensive, it in essence ran out the people that were putting vests together that were quote unquote the little guys. And so, you know, you really now you've got the majority of it, overwhelming majority is the big players in vest manufacturing now.
Yeah, and I hate to say it, I think it's a good thing.
And that is exactly what they were after.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I really hate the fact that they knocked out the little guys, because I love small businesses and being mm-hmm. a small business owner, that's the lifeblood of the country. But sometimes some things need to be handled by the big guys with the amazing and very strict quality control that a small person just can't do.
And this is a prime example of one of the best reasons, actually. And you say you like the little guy in little business. Government loves the little business. Minority owned, small businesses, they love it. And that's why there were originally so many of them out there doing that. So, you know, now though, there's changes. And like I say, it's basically run them out to the point where you've got, you know, the majority of what's left over are the big guys.
So here's a question that was posted to the Facebook page, and it comes from Sean. And he asks, how long can you reasonably expect a vest to last, and how would you be able to tell if it was no longer reliable?
Well, once again, it depends on how are you using the vest. has it been shot? Number one. Number two, you know, have you been taking reasonable care of it? Coming from just the material standpoint of it, I do know that they will tout with vests. They'll tout a number of years that they recommend, you know, I guess, again, calling it basically like a shelf life of it. I would go by those guidelines.
Do they come with a stamp of an expiration date?
I think they probably have. And again, I don't know the legal part of that from the vest folks. I don't know exactly how they handle that. I do know that, you know, I guess the general outlook of that, you know, depending on what it's made for, can be like somewhere between 5 and 10 years, just depending on what it is. But again, I can't be held to that because, I, you know, they're basically like guidelines, I guess. you know, and as a matter of fact, in the same vein, I had someone pose a question to me, you know, via email that kind of falls along the same lines that said, well, okay, would a vest that's out of date be better than not having a vest? And, I, you know, what a good question. And I'm thinking, you know, so you've got a vest that you can get like maybe dirt cheap compared to a new one, obviously. Would you want to buy that and wear that obsolete spent vest, so to speak, versus not having one at all? So would it be better just to buy something instead of having nothing? And, you know, I don't know, obviously. I can tell you this. Anything between you and that bullet is going to be good, you know? And I would say that, you know, it wouldn't hurt. I'm not saying everybody go run out and buy a vest or something that, you know, has been obsolete, that's been spent or used. And, you know, say law enforcement had it, now they're just selling them. And, you know, I don't know if they come back, these people that retail sell those out or whoever sells them. Would say, you know, with a caveat, hey, these are just for, you know, novelty now. Don't use them. I don't know about that. But, you know, honestly, a great big coat, you know, is better. Because you've heard stories about how like a 45 had got stopped by down coat. I mean, you know, I've heard those stories in the past. Whether they're true or not, I don't know. But the whole thing in a nutshell is, you know, is it better? You know, it's going to be better than having nothing between you. But, you know, obviously I would prefer to have one that's within the dates, you know, they're recommending. Because once a number of years goes by, it's just like anything. If you wear a shirt and the shirt's great and you take care of it, eventually the shirt starts getting tattered and get holes and problems with it, you know, but it's nothing that you've really done other than just to wear it. So is there a true stamp date? I don't know. As far as the materials go, no. Now, is there a stamp date that the vest manufacturers put on that? I don't know that they have a date that says do not go past this line. Maybe they have some type of guideline, I would imagine, that says, look, you know, we don't recommend, or, you know, something like that, because the liability there, I imagine, would be enormous. But again, I can't speak for them. I can only just kind of give you basically what I feel from the, yeah, I guess, the science and materials part of it.
Speaking of the science of materials, and along the vein of that question,
mm-hmm.
How fast is the degradation once it passes its expiration date? Does it turn to dust? Is it a slow degrading where the fibers start to decay in patches? Does the whole thing go as an entire layer? How fast does the reliability disappear once that expiration date has been met?
Well, that's hard to answer. And the reason I say that is, again, it depends on what the use of it was, how it was taken care of. Obviously, if you take a single layer of fabric, Kevlar fabric, and lay it out in the sun, you know, it's going to, I mean, you know, it's not going to be just a matter of hours or days. I've never really done that, so I don't know exactly how long it would take. But I know I've had rolls of the material in areas kind of uncovered. And they're still there, and that's been years now.
So that's just in your lab environment?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You know, and again, well, we've had some that are near the dock that we hadn't set outside, but obviously that dock door comes open and closed, and it's, once again, it's remained, you know, intact. Now, does that mean that the strength of it may have gone down? Yeah, it's very possible. I would imagine it has, but there again, we haven't measured it to find out. So I imagine there is something that will give you some type of information on how long it would be like that. But I really am not aware of anything like that.
And the problem is you can't really test it because the testing process destroys it.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So it's like, oh yeah, that would have worked, but now it won't.
So that's right.
Ooh, okay, it would have been all right, but yeah, well. A question from Charles on the Facebook page, he asks, what materials would you recommend avoiding and why? And how accurate are the DOJ specs?
What would I recommend avoiding?
Yeah.
Anything that's not. let me just put it this way. The first thing I recommend is distance. don't get anywhere near anything that's going to be shooting at you.
Well, I'm thinking that because we talked about other fibers for a little bit for a while as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, well, okay, let's just take that as examples. There's fibers called like Dyneema is another one. Now, basically, that's not like a Kevlar. It's not the para-aramid. Dyneema is like ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene. Now, the claim for that, you know, it's got lighter weight to it, different properties to it. They're strong. They're just as strong. And, you know, in some instances, depending on the thickness of the yarns or fibers, and they could be very, you know, even stronger, depending on, you know, the characteristics of how they've made it. But again, it's a different polymer than that of Kevlar. And I remember people saying, well, I've got this Dyneema thing that's been, you know, as a security guard, or I remember reading on one of our forums, you know, so Dyneema, man, tell me about Dyneema. And it's like, hey, it's good. Dyneema's good too. You know, also the way the fabric is produced, you know, what we do woven materials, and they may be plain type weaves. They may be weaves that are very tight, some that are a little looser with coarser yarns in them or coarser filaments. Then there's others that are like, look similar to a twill type that increases strength as far as the fabric goes, but are heavier, not as flexible in some instances. Then there's, you know, another question that came up was, well, what about like something that's like gold shield? And okay, so here are aramid fabrics, and these, and we may have touched on this, but they're unidirectional fabrics. And it's like, well, what is that? Well, you know, when you weave a fabric, you have what's called a warp direction, which is basically these yarns come off of what was called a beam. And it's just all these yarns are lined up side by side on this enormous beam that weighs thousands of pounds. And so you hook that to the front of a loom, and then these beams go through what we call heddles that actually create what's called a shed that opens and closes so that the yarn that comes across the width of it, which is called a pick, will go through that shed. In old days, you've heard of a shuttle loom or a shuttle, and it literally looks like a shuttle. What happens is the filament yarn would actually be in that projectile, and the projectile would be knocked from one side of the loom to the other side of the loom once the shed was opened with these heddles. So you've got half the yarns in a plane weave going up, half the yarns in the plane weave going down, and that's every other yarn that way.
Did they make you take knitting classes before when you started
applying
for this job?
Oh, I took that stuff. Not knitting, sewing. I mean, weaving.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely part of it. You got your PhD in chemistry, and all of a sudden you're talking about
polymer
shuttles and
well, polymer science. Well, and of course we weave. I mean, you know, that's our business too, is to sell a lot of that woven materials. But so what happens, you know, and nowadays it's different. They have what's called rapier looms and, you know, air jet looms. Air jet's not typically used with these materials because they damage the yarns. And that's one thing you don't want. But like a rapier loom has a rapier, and you think of a rapier as a sword, for instance. It's very similar. It's a rod that shoots out, grabs this pick, which is the yarn that shoots across the width of it. And it literally grabs the end of it, goes halfway, and another rod on the other side comes out and grabs it and pulls it the rest of the way. All that happens within like a millisecond, and it, you know, the shed will change. The yarns that were up will now be down, and the ones that are down will now be up. And so that's how you get that weave in a plain weave, for instance, where the yarns are going over and under and over and under and over and under. So that's a woven, you know, plain woven fabric, okay? And that's a lot of the majority of, like, the Kevlar fabrics are that way, and some of these, you know, others like the Dyneema or Spectra. The unidirectional ones are not woven. What they are yarns that are laid side by side, and it's encompassed in a matrix of some type of resin system. That resin basically creates what looks like a ribbon. Of course, it's a ribbon, the width of, you know, whatever your broad width is that you want. But again, the yarns are all laid out side by side, just, you know, very evenly spaced out. Well, then what will happen is, to create the panel, they will come back and cut that as a sheet, so to speak, then turn it 90 degrees. And now you have yarns laying in one direction, and then 90 degrees, those same yarns, you know, of a different sheet laying in the other direction. And you do that multiple times, and it creates a panel. Now, they say, well, what, you know, what good is that? You know, you've got a woven fabric, and then you've got, well, there's no buckle. There's no knuckle there where the yarn actually goes up and then goes down, because that leaves what's called interstices, which is a hole. So, like, if you take a T-shirt and you hold the T-shirt up to the light, you can see through it. Well, that's because you have holes in that fabric, and those holes are where the material, well, T-shirt's not a good example because it's a knit, but if you look through other woven materials, you'll actually see the holes, the interstices through that. The light comes through it, and that's where you're seeing that. Well, that's a weak point. That's a weak spot. And you're not allowing that fiber to do its job to protect there. So if you line them up, they're side by side, you've got even distribution of protection and strength with these fibers. So now the yarns and fibers are laid up at 90 degrees to each other. There's no knuckle there. There's no buckle and knuckle and crimp in this fiber. It's all straight. So you've got a lot more strength in that sense.
So it's laid out like plywood.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good example. You know, when you have that, it may not be quite as flexible, but there again, you imparted a little better strength in it, which means that you can possibly use less, which will lower the weight, increase the strength of it by lowering the weight. So the flexibility kind of goes up anyway, because now you don't have, you know, the added weight or, you know, layers to it. So, you know, I think Honeywell produces Gold Flex. Maybe it's Gold Flex, Gold Shield. And someone asked, well, what about that? You know, I'm hearing this stuff. It's good. It's a good material too. And again, that's all produced. That material is produced by Honeywell, which is a big name, obviously. There has been talk in the industry that unidirectional is kind of the wave of the future, you know, to a certain degree. So, you know, I feel safe in that as well. And Alex, in regards to like the NIJ testing, what that is basically a specification. And I guess the question that you had posed from the listener that said, how accurate are they? Well, I mean, they're 100% accurate. They're 100% accurate in what they ask, because that's what these things do. That's what they ask you to meet a standard like this. So basically, the threat level, for instance, I don't have the charts in front of me, and so I'm going to just give out, you know, just totally irrelevant numbers, but just to give you an example of the pattern. So like if you've got a projectile that weighs this much, that's being shot at this speed, say let's pull up an arbitrary number of say 1500 feet or 2500 feet per second, for instance. Okay. 50% of those should be stopped and 50% can go through. Well, does that mean that you want it up to that point? No. What it means is it gives you a level to say you need to stay under. And so the question really isn't a question you can answer in the way I think they're asking it. They're asking it, how accurate is this material that you're putting out? You know, the NIJ is just asking you to meet a standard. So you could get like, you know, a vest that's rated to a level, two, or, you know, 2A, 3, whatever, 3A, and actually it perform over that. It's very possible.
So it's a minimum requirement.
Yeah.
And the way they set their tests up is makes sense from a scientific perspective, but maybe not from a general usage perspective. It's like in the scientific process, the null hypothesis. And mm-hmm. the whole point of your experiment is to disprove your null hypothesis, which
right.
sounds, in a normal circumstance, completely back-assward.
Right.
But from a scientific perspective and a testing perspective, it makes complete sense.
Right. You want to know where it fails. I mean, that's the most important thing, is to find out where it fails. Because if it stops, you know it stops the material there. So you want to go further than that. And you want to come up to the point where you can find a spot where basically 50% of the projectiles that are static at this point. We're talking about roughly the same speed, because you'll never get them exactly the same speed. It never does happen. And anybody should know that that enjoys shooting firearms. But, you know, 50% would go through and 50% would be stopped. And that gives you exactly where you know it's you know, I guess, the break point, so to speak. And so, in essence, you're keeping under that, because the further down in the threat itself, then the higher percentage you're going to get of it stopping. So, you know, if you're asking for a question, if the listener or somebody else would be asking for a question, well, how do I know there's a guarantee that I'm getting, and this is what I think they're asking, that I'm getting a level 2 vest that is going to stop the threat level that it says it's going to stop? How do you, well, you know, again, there's no guarantees. There's just no guarantees. You can say statistically across the whole life of the product, everything that's been tested, we've noticed, you know, basically this is stopped with the threat that you're talking about. And that's why they put that out there, you know. But again, there's other characteristics or other things that come into play, like angle of incidence. I mean, you know, were you turned when you were shot? Was it a head-on shot? You know, again, you can't go. The imagination is purely, truly the limit. I mean, it's just you can't come up with every scenario and have an exacting measurement for it. It's just impossible to do it. That's why these things are never sold, stating, okay, here's a vest. It will stop this no matter what. So if you wear this, you're A-okay. You just can't. There's no way to do that, because they're not bulletproof. They are bullet resistant. It's helping you out. It's helping you out. So, you know, I know that's kind of a hard way to answer. It's really a hard question to answer in the way I'm pretty sure that it was being asked. But the truth of the answer for the question is all the NIJ does is to produce a number, a metric that you can go by to try to make sure that it meets that metric. So the answer to the question truly is 100% accurate, because that's what they're asking you to do. Now, is the material that way? Well, that's up to the manufacturer, and of course, the testing is being done for it.
Well. So in a lab environment under specific conditions, yes. In real world, anything can happen.
Even in lab environments sometimes, who knows? I mean, again, it's true. It's true. That's why, you know, a V50, and again, that's the velocity where 50% go through and 50 don't. It can change from panel to panel. That's why they do multiple panels. That's why they do multiple shots. That's why you don't just shoot one panel one time and walk away and say you've got it. You got to have more data points, and it gives you a greater statistical average at that point, which, of course, it opens up an enormous amount of other statistics that you can, you know, apply to it. But again, there's no guarantees ever in anything. You know, if you're standing with, you know, 10 inches of, you know, hardened metal between you and a, 30-06, you know, that's steel core that's being shot at you. You know, how do you feel about that? Well, what if that metal's weak in a spot? You know, you don't know. I mean, there's just so much involved. But the thing is, they wouldn't be selling and making these things the way they are. They've been used for, you know, and proven in all types of adverse conditions. Our troops carry them. The police carry them. You know, they're being sold. And, you know, oddly enough, you know, you would think with the way, the nature of this stuff, the liability that's involved, there'd be just lawsuit upon lawsuit upon lawsuit. And there are some, but it's nothing like you could imagine. You've probably got just as many lawsuits based on airbags in cars, I would imagine, you know, in certain circumstances. But this stuff has been out there. It works. And, you know, Kevlar is my favorite, I think, because I work the most with that. I'm most familiar with that. You know, we have a good relationship with DuPont to where we work with them. And then, you know, also it's been out there the longest. I mean, you know, basically it's been out the longest and been used, you know, in all types of theater and venue for, you know, all types of different, you know, law enforcement, like I say, military, in the civilian or contracting. So, you know, it's good stuff. That's the stuff I'd want to have. Again, to sum up with the Dyneema and the others, great too. The Honeywell type stuff, I can't speak from the vest standpoint for any of that, but I can tell you the materials are good materials.
Okay, Doc, you know, I appreciate you coming back. Now we've covered a couple additional topics here in depth, and they were representative of the whole host of questions because there was a lot of very similar themed type questions. So we picked a couple out and we covered them in detail. I hope we got them all answered. I think that we did. Mm-hmm. You know, if we don't, you know, send us more questions, guys. Doc would be more than happy to come on, right, Doc?
Oh, yeah.
Kind of set me up there.
Yeah, I do. And again, I know that a lot of these, you know, answers seem to be vague and may even create more questions in your head as to, well, wait a minute, do I really want this stuff? You know, but the truth of the matter is, it's like I said before, you're looking at it as a resistance versus a being proof in it. It's, you know, obviously it wouldn't be made and sold in the way it's done if it didn't work. So this is just the science behind it. And, you know, there's obvious liabilities and all. So you'll never find somebody that'll give you 100% guarantee on it. You just won't. But I'm hoping it did satiate some folks for the questions that they've got. Hopefully I didn't, because you did very well, but but I didn't sprawl it out to the point where they're more confused now than they were. And hopefully folks will see that they can have a little more confidence, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, bottom line, it's a lot better than your own hide.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. So. Absolutely.
Okay, Doc. Well, thanks again for coming on. It's been wonderful chatting with you, and we look forward to having you on future shows.
Alex, I really do appreciate it, and thank you to the listeners for paying attention. I'm sorry if I rambled too much, but thanks to everybody. Thanks again, Alex.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Gun Rights Radio Network has the best pro Second Amendment, pro gun rights podcast available on the net. The podcasts are absolutely free when subscribing using iTunes or Zoom Marketplace. Or if you want, you can just listen from the website. Make sure you visit gunrightsradio.com to subscribe. Podcasting freedom, one episode at a time.
Hey, everybody, we are
Lady Antebellum.
Before every show, we practice. Gotta be prepared.
Exactly. And the American Red Cross wants us to be prepared, too. Prepared for disaster. This
world. Just take 3 steps to be Red Cross ready. Create a disaster supplies kit with water, food, and a first aid kit. Make a family communication plan and listen to local radio and TV reports to stay informed.
It's that simple. To learn more, visit redcross.org or contact your local Red Cross chapter today. Thank you so much.
Practical Defense is a member of the Gun Rights Radio Network at gunrightsradio.com. And that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense Podcast. For questions, tips, comments, or topic suggestions, send us an email at podcast@palladium-education.com. That's podcast@palladium-education.com. Or leave us a voicemail at 805-203-6586. I look forward to hearing from you. Practical Defense Podcast and theme music are copyright Palladium Education Incorporated.
You can now hear Gun Rights Radio Network while you're on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. On-demand news, talk, and more on your mobile phone. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed, and no memory or storage wasted. Available for your iPhone, Android phones, or your BlackBerry. Downloading is easy. Go to Stitcher.com or check out your app store. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Gun Rights Radio Network shows can be found under Sources.